You are listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help keep us the podcast going by donating to the show. We are also grateful and proud to be supported by the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies.
Today, we thought it would be timely for the Talking About Organizations podcast to explore some scholarly writing about disaster, risk, difficult situations, and also recovery, because it relates very nicely to the situation the world, not just any particular country, finds itself in with the coronavirus. And as scholars of organizations and management theory, we're interested in exploring what the classics of organizational science can provide for us in a way of perspective, ways to analyze and think about this situation. This is Dr. Ralph Soule coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
This is Greta coming from a lush urban jungle in Oxford.
And this is Pedro coming to you from an apartment in the Haut Quartier in Lyon, France.
This is Michael coming to you from my home at Utrecht in the Netherlands.
Well, it's good to know that we're all safe and properly sequestered, as we say in the United States, in our domiciles. We're going to explore two articles today. One is by Carl Weick, a paper written in 1990, The Vulnerable System, an analysis of the Tenerife air disaster that appeared in the Journal of Management. And we're also going to look at a different article, much more recent, but still not last year, by Paoli, Reclaiming Resilience and Safety, Resilience Activation in the Critical Period of Crisis. And both articles look at risk and resilience, but from different perspectives, and that's why we thought they would be most interesting, because they speak to different parts of the crisis. In The Vulnerable System, the focus is on processes by which crises are set in motion. And specifically, Weick is looking at our understanding of the ways in which separate small failures become linked. And we certainly know that a single cause incidents are rare. Many times there's what is referred to in the literature as a causal chain. But it's not well understood, and certainly wasn't well understood before Weick wrote his article, about how these small events can link together so that they produce a disastrous outcome. And in the article, Weick looks at several processes that amplify the risks and effects and the linkages. One is the interruption of important routines. Number two is the regression to more habituated ways of responding when you're being interrupted, and that this is the tendency to refer to back to things you know really well, or sometimes this is referred to as muscle memory in physical training and such, but there's sort of a mental muscle memory that we know in organizations. The breakdown of coordination of action, which you would argue in management and organizations is fundamental to getting good outcomes. And it's not often understood well how these things break down. And the fourth one is misunderstanding in speech exchange systems, which is really, really important in high-risk operations, so that everybody understands clearly the terminology and what is meant. And Weick explores that in some detail. And when they occur in the context of a system that is becoming what Weick described as more tightly coupled and less linear, it causes a great problem for the system. And one of the great insights of Weick in this article is to describe systems that are not necessarily complex at the beginning and not necessarily highly linked, but can become so over time. Because I think that was one of his wonderful contributions, is that before this writing, it was often written and conceived of as, an organization is either tight or complex, or tight or linear, or complex or simple. and it stays in that condition. And White drew our attention to, no, you also have to pay attention to the ways that they transition from one region to another. And then later I will go into the chronology of the actual accent, which I think would be helpful for people to know. But contrasting with Wyke, we have the article that focuses on resilience by Pauli. I'm really glad that Greta recommended this article, because before reading it, I never really thought very much about resilience in an organizational sense being something that is constructed after the fact. As a person who's operated in many highly reliable organizations and done much disaster training, I think of resilience as a prior condition or prior characteristic. I'm certainly aware that organizations cope, but this is more of a focus on a resilience and coping strategies. That's what Pauli is writing about. And Pauli emphasized through narrative vignettes, after an unexpected organizational event, in this case it was a shooting at a business school, how the resilience actually gets activated. It's not something just sitting there in a desk drawer or in somebody's closet. There are mechanisms that Pauli identified that activate the resilience, which I thought fascinating, because I'm actually more of the desk drawer kind of guy. I thought it was just something you found when you were looking for it, or was an organizational property. And according to Pauli, it has to be created by people, and there's means by which it's created. Pauli identifies this was a gap at the time of the writing in the reliability and resilience literature, because a lot of the resilience literature focuses on engineering resilience and design, and those are all very important things. As Pauli or others will tell you, you still have problems. You can still have big issues, and some of these things can actually wipe out an organization or cause it to cease to function. And Pauli was more interested in how do these organizations recover? How does this mechanism occur? And the author identified essentially three social mechanisms by which resilience gets activated. Limnal suspension, and for those that struggle with liminality like I do, I imagine it as being a border between two states that's crossed by a bridge, and there's many physical borders like this. And liminality refers to that gap or that distance between the borders. And we often what I love about the concept of liminality is we often think of borders as being these fixed things in time and they don't change. And so another way to think of it is gray zone, right? This kind of, but it's a focus on the border or the area between the borders and how the borders can shift. And that's what Pauli writes about, is about this idea that the original borders shift as a result of this activation of resilience, which I thought was a really interesting idea about forming new relationships at the border in liminality between the former times and the current time, or between parts of the organization. And then the second mechanism is the liminal suspension that activates the other two. That's a very important concept. That actually comes first. And then it activates compassionate witnessing, which is essentially people telling their story about what they saw and sharing their experiences and developing joint understandings. Because it's one thing to say, well, I was in the crisis and I experienced it this way. But then for me to talk to Greta or Michael, Pedro, and say, find out, oh, they experienced it completely differently, or they had these other ideas that I didn't even consider, which helps us make sense in a retrospective sense. And the author talks about that compassionate sense making in the article. And then the last one is relational redundancy. We can all say, oh, those are really good ideas, but this is more an issue of where you activate them through this process. For example, I might never have a reason to talk to Pedro because he's in a different department, but we sit together at lunch, and through this sharing of the stories and our experiences, we form new relationships. Or I didn't even know Michael was in the group or was in this other part of the building or something, but now I do know this. And so it's a very intriguing idea about the social mechanisms by which these things occur. And with that brief introduction to both works, I invite observations and comments from the team members.
Yeah, so when sometimes you read these organizational literature and they really touch you, right? So this was one of the articles. This is an article I read about 10 years ago for the first time. And, you know, organization studies and organizational studies literature Well, there are, of course, examples that are boring. And what can we learn from this? And this is of course, an intriguing case, specifically for me being Dutch, being flying with KLM as well. And actually, when I read this article for the first time, it took me back to a youth memory, because I didn't live in 1977 when the crash occurred. I was born in 1980, but I know about the crash because of stories of my father, and specifically because we went in 1987. We went with KLM to Tenerife, and so my father told this this story. I remember this, and it stuck with me, and it also kind of re-engaged when other aircraft disasters happen. So I don't know if this is the bad luck of the Dutch, but in 1992 we had a major aircraft disaster in Amsterdam. In 2010 we had a major aircraft disaster with many Dutch people involved in the in Tripoli, Africa, and then in 2014 we again had another major aircraft assault above Ukraine, so in which many of my fellow countrymen died. And so this is kind of something about a disaster that really sticks with you in a way. And but what the article really where the article really drew my attention about 10 years ago was, of course, more the organizational issues that are raised by WAIC, and there are many in the article. So I'm kind of curious, which is the one organizational topic that draws your attention? To me, it was mostly the team dynamics that are analyzed within the article, specifically the team of the KLM cockpit that's involved. But I'm curious what other organizational topics that are coming to your mind.
So before maybe we expand on other topics, I'm going to build on that, because the article is very rich. But I think that one of the core insights lies exactly there. Ralph gave a great insight and overview on what the article is doing. And I think it's important to say that this is very much an agenda-setting paper. The very way in which it's written, it is, you know, WAIC is using this case and bringing a set of sensitivities to try to understand that and point out how different perspectives and concepts, many of them are new, some of them are just reworked, and he acknowledges that, allow to see it in a different way when they are brought together. And he also lists a lot of future indications for research. So he has this spirit of, you know, thinking about disasters in such a way that is expanding the understanding that disasters can have in many situations, because it's not just there are, as Ralph mentioned, simple and complex organizations, but actually simple can become very complex and become also very highly interdependent. And also trying to show that the disaster doesn't just come from one big thing, but come from many small issues, and therefore it's important to look at the way people act and react, and, you know, shifting the focus exactly on that. Not just the structures that are in place, not just the type of organizations, but as we organize, as we inhabit organizations, how can we do in such a way to prevent disasters, which he claims it's, you know, it's potentially relevant and it's becoming more and more given technology and so on and so forth. The teamwork is very important, because I think that a lot of stories we have, think about even good stories about disaster avoidance, we have a bias for heroes. You know, when I read the paper, I thought instantly about the case of the, you know, the other side of the coin could be the story of the Hudson River, in which the pilot managed to land on the river and nobody was killed and all that, you know, that miracle that happened. And the story is usually told very much as the pilot, which of course exhibits an immense amount of expertise and control and everything. But this is, you know, we know from organizational theory, and I think that's the core thing, the insight that we can bring, is that it's always a process that involves multiple people, multiple things that are there, you know. So I just want to expand a bit on that.
I think that was a good expansion, Pedro, and I like the way you emphasized teamwork, which is what I was going to tell Michael. That's one thing that really resonated with me, not just the importance of teamwork, but how it can be dysfunctional or how it cannot work. Because we see a lot of those kinds of crew resource management issues and teamwork failures in the Navy. Because Navy also has many circumstances where hierarchy gets in the way or becomes an obstacle to good communications, and White covers that. The other thing that really resonated with me, and I would say this is equal with teamwork, is stress. Because you get in these situations where stress causes changes, not only physiological, which I thought White covered quite well, but mental. How do you deal with all these interruptions and the stress that's caused when all these things start to become additive? And I think until I read this paper, I mostly looked at stress as a physiological, oh, you have troubles at work or a very high workload. And this is really talking about micro stress or micro levels and how these incidents build. And a final thing to me, which I think is, I rank them all as all important, is this notion that the nature of the organization's complexity, either simple or complex or basic or complex, and then its coupling between elements, whether it's linear or tightly coupled, is the other way to say it, can change. Because that was quite the aha for me to say, I never really realized that. I thought you would go in with one organization structure and you'd come out the same way. And yet, Wyke tells us you need to pay attention. Because even if you went into the situation in one circumstance, the nature of the changes and the stress and the interruptions can cause your coupling to change. And that really stood out for me.
To build on that, I was kind of reviewing the notes that I made while reading and thinking about, you know, what were the different types of organizational processes that Wyke highlighted in his paper. And I really thought that was like one of the beauties of the paper. And we can talk about it later, what type of paper this is from an academic standpoint. But he points out four processes. And one is the interruption of important routines, where you have to deviate from the usual, where you have to understand that this is a crisis and you have to improvise. So where formal processes and practices sometimes have to be replaced by improvising. And to the regression to more habituated ways of responding. And I think that kind of points to what you mentioned, Ralph, is this how stress really affects our cognition and how the mind works when we're under high stress. And then the other two points that White points out is the breakdown of coordinated action and kind of the misunderstandings in the speak exchange systems and how there were some glitches in the communication technology that was used. And so important messages were misinterpreted and interpreted in a way that they thought the message was rather than listening to the actual message. And always being interested in how work takes place, I was really interested in the roles and role relations that were described in the paper, and where, of course, we understand, like, you know, in the air traffic control cockpit, as well as among the pilots, you have a very hierarchical, formal context where there are clearly described roles and are clearly described role relations. And what I really liked was what I really liked was the relation between the first pilot and assistant pilot in the KLM airplane, and where the first pilot actually was a training pilot that I think for 10 years had been a training
instructor.
Yes, and he two months before the accident happened, he had passed the second pilot his exam. So I thought that was a very interesting one, and how in the unfolding of this disaster, that role relationship between those two impacted the way they acted upon signals they got, the way they interpreted those signals, and how they did or did not feel they could intervene.
I think that's a very clear connection also to the Kurt Lewine episode that we had last year on the group dynamics. And, you know, the idea of interpretation of kind of expecting something of your superior and the silencing of your own interpretation or voice. That's really that's really pointed out by Wyck. And I kind of was intrigued by his double notion of synergy. So within this role relationship and this working within the team, this can work towards synergy. But he mentions it as a positive synergy or a negative synergy. And I never thought of synergy as being negative in a way. So that really struck my mind from this aspect of the article. Yeah,
I really like that emphasis on the potential for negative synergy, or essentially taking what the relationship you have and making it worse because of these stresses. There's a couple of things that Greta said I wanted to react to because I thought they were very interesting. So she was talking about communications. One of the things that struck me about the article was this idea that not only do you have to have standard communications that everybody understands the meaning of and are well recognized, but the clarity with which you issue them is very important. So I'll give you an example from the Navy, and I'm sure many organizations have this. In the Navy, if you're trying to communicate with somebody, whether on the radio or on other kind of communications, you do not say the words, if you want to take the value of some parameter and make it go up or down, I mean, very careful how I phrase this for a reason, you do not say increase or decrease. And the reason is, if I'm sitting next to Greta, it's easy to say that because she knows what I'm going to say. Now, if I get half a room away from Greta, maybe a little bit harder to tell the difference between increase and decrease because they sound so similar. And now if I get in a noisy communication circuit with lots of machinery and she's trying to distinguish my voice from a spinning large turbine, it's a terrible way to communicate. So in the Navy, our standard, and it's just one of many, is if you want the value to go up, you say raise. And if you want the value or the machine to slow down, you say lower. And it's nearly impossible to confuse those two terms, raise and lower. And that's an example of how not only do the communications have specific meanings, and standard communications, that you say them a particular way, and when somebody doesn't do that, there's quite a bit of ambiguity created, and Wyck devotes quite a bit of space in the article to what people might have thought we are at takeoff means. And that's the whole reason why you emphasize that standard communication, so you don't have that kind of ambiguity, because that's deadly, in this case, literally. The other thing I think is interesting is, I think by the nature of the way Wyck wrote the article, he focused on the members of the cockpit and the roles. And that was another thing that Greta really identified well, their roles and how the nature of power relationships, is what she was, I think, emphasizing. The fact that the lead pilot was this very, very senior trainer, and the junior, the less experienced pilot had just been qualified. So therefore, not only is he feeling a little experienced, but there was this great power gap between them. And that's actually one of the things crew resource management attacked directly and saying, we can't be safe if the power relationships are getting in the way of clear communications. And there's a famous example of an airline that had significant problems. It was the Korean airline, and I'm not criticizing anybody from Korea directly, but they did have some safety issues, and they were traced back to the culture of the cockpit. And in the days when this criticism was occurring, the power of the Korean Airlines captain was absolute. He did not tolerate any suggestions or any other advice or any corrections, which is, we believe in now, is not good for safety, where it creates negative synergism, as Michael would say, which I think is a good way to say it. And so there's a famous case where they're talking on the radio, and it's actually recorded, where the pilot is speaking, the co-pilot is trying to give a reminder, and there's this large in the background, and we're pretty sure that was the pilot slapping the co-pilot for speaking up. And that became a a cause célèbre or something where we say, that's an indication that they might have some power distance issues in that cockpit. And then one last part I want to emphasize is that the WIC focuses on the cockpit crew and a little bit of the Pan Am crew, but mostly on the KLM crew. And I think that's important focus because it would get distracting otherwise. However, it's important to remember there were multiple teams engaged. So not only did you have the team of the Pan Am, that's pretty clear because you hear a little bit about their communications and what the pilot said, but the air traffic controllers are another team. And so not only do they have to deal with these same kinds of issues internal to air traffic control and the cockpit, but they must bridge those so they function reliably as a system, because airline travel doesn't work, modern airline travel doesn't work, at the airport at any rate, without good cooperation between air traffic control and the pilot. So there's many, many norms and ways of communicating. And one thing I think, I'm not, you know, Mike did a little bit of guessing here, and I'm always alert to areas where people are trying to make guesses. And I'm not criticizing him, but he was guessing, well, the air traffic controllers at the airport were speaking in a second language and it might have been difficult for them. Well, except when you realize all air traffic control, all of it is in English. That's the international language. You can't be an air traffic controller if you don't speak English extremely well. So yes, I imagine it could have been fatiguing, but you can't have a job like that if you're not, your English language skills aren't really good. Now, I get it. You could have an accent. That could happen. Right? I'm not criticizing people with accents, but your English skills must be very, very high. And that's also why, for example, the KLM pilots, a lot of their language is in English. I'm reasonably sure, because White doesn't talk about translations. Because once again, it's hideously difficult to analyze the cockpit recordings if they're in some other language and you're using terminology that's peculiar to that language and those sorts of things. And just for Michael's benefit, I don't think it's a Dutch curse. I just think things went wrong at the wrong time. And I'm proud of him for hearing that story from his father en route to Tenerife and not jumping out of the plane. So I'm proud of you, buddy. That was some serious self-control.
Okay. So, first of all, I totally want to second what Ralph said about the safety of the airline industry, having done my PhD in aircraft manufacture. You know, the engineers I study used to joke that people should be afraid of cars and elevators, not planes. But, you know, jokes aside, I also got a little bit annoyed in that little guessing regarding the language thing. So I'm glad that, Ralph, you brought it up, because, you know, it sounds a little belittling in a way, you know, but, you know, it we all have flaws and we all have biases in when we write, but, you know, just a side note. But anyway, what I really wanted to talk about was to reflect on some stuff that Greta and Ralph just talked about in terms of teamwork and roles, because it's very interesting that one of the things that Vike is trying to do is to move away from this idea that structures are just there. You know, he shows that enactment matters. And he acknowledges when he talks about communication, as Ralph mentioned, the importance of external communication. But then I see some dichotomy. And as someone that's interested in the formal side of organizing and its relation with, you know, the emergent one, I found a bit problematic, you know, this idea that hierarchy gets on the way of expertise, this idea that, you know, there is the formal, in a way, is preventing voice from people. Because just to give an example from the podcast, we have our episode based on the paper by Burley and Spender on culture and high reliability, which is about now the culture in the Navy. And one of the things that seems important there is exactly, from what I remember, the way in which hierarchy is enacted, right? In which you can have the formal hierarchy, but also acknowledge the importance of professional expertise, and that has its role. Also, there is, you know, we must acknowledge, to go back to the case that you were given from the Korean situation, certainly that is relevant, but we can also think it upside down. That is, having hierarchy is also limits cognitive complexity. It resolves issue of division of work and so on and so forth. So it's important not to, you know, I felt it was this nuance was a little bit missing in the paper. And it was interesting because it seems that if you just follow Vike through and through, you'd arrive there, but it seemed that he stopped a little short from that that kind of, you know, implication of his own thought.
Let me respond to that, because what I thought was actually we are discussing a situation where there were multiple repertoires of how to enact hierarchy. And this was exactly what I wanted to bring into the conversation, is the role of simulation. And Wyke dedicates quite a bit of attention to the way pilots are trained in simulation contexts. And one thing he points out that was a key difference between the reality and the simulation is that when you're doing a simulation, you get very few instructions from an air traffic control room. Usually you ask for clearance rather than await clearance. And what happened, at least that's what Wyke suggests is what happened, is that because of the high stress, they had been flying for 11 hours. They were going against their legal limits. They had to make this very complicated turn of a very big airplane and a very little runway to make the turn. And the cloudy situation, the bad weather, it kind of distress led to the key pilot enacting the repertoire of the training context, the simulation context, where he requested clearance rather than awaited. So it's not about whether hierarchy is bad, but it was that the simulation context didn't have the right hierarchy. It didn't have the same hierarchy as in reality. And this is where you see, like, we should not see this as one organization. This is an inter-organizational process where you need to have very clear role relations across organizations, between the control room, with the pilot, with the co-pilot, and also between different airplanes and their cockpits.
Well, that's a wonderful insight, Greta. And I think it's these interactions of these other contexts or situations that's really, really important, because it's easy to think of, well, the simulator was just this other place and it doesn't really apply. And yet Wyke is showing it does. And I think to add to what Greta said, not only was the interaction with air traffic control different, but in the case of an instructor pilot, he is air traffic control because he wants to focus on what the pilots are doing. So he's typically outside the cockpit. He's on some kind of communication circuits. And the pilot in the cockpit, in the simulator, is going to request authorization to take off from the instructor because the instructor plays different roles during the simulation. So that was a really great observation, Greta. And I think this is one of the recognitions or great insights of crew resource management, is that you may not be able to prevent that. That may be asking too much from people, but what you can do as a pilot is create the space for your crew to say, I think that's a mistake, or I think you should do that differently, or we don't really have clearance. And that's how the focus of communications has changed, in that they weren't able to invent that on the fly in the cockpit under all that stress. And now we've realized, okay, you can't really make the stress go away, and that's going to happen. And you can't really make all the interactions with air traffic control perfect. And you can't, as Greta noted, eliminate the context of the simulator training, because it's going to be there. So perhaps what you can do is create an aid in the way you communicate and coordinate your actions. So I think one of the insights of crew resource management that Wyke indicates. He doesn't really talk about that because this was prior to those days, but it really shows why that's so useful.
Completely agree. And change topics a bit, I want to say a little bit about what I really liked about this paper and why I think it's so relevant for the situation we're in now. And, you know, like what Wyke does, like reading this paper, I was like, it's so beautifully written. I love the way the narrative unfolds. I love how it starts with a phenomenon. And then it doesn't claim a major theoretical innovation or contribution. No, it brings together and synthesizes literature from psychology about how the brain works, how we deal under stress and emotion. It brings group dynamics. It brings communication theory into the conversation and comes up with this kind of conceptual language that helps us understand why things happened as they happened. Because, you know, when you first hear it, like two airplanes going towards each other and crashing, like, how is this possible? But then he explains with existing knowledge and insights from organization theory why it is that this disaster could happen. And then he says, you know, this knowledge is important and everybody should know it, because then we can act upon that knowledge and prevent disasters rather than acting after the fact, after it happened. And when you go to the end of the paper, you know, instead of claiming like a major theoretical novelty that will change the world, and he actually says, you know, here are 7 implications for practice. This is what we, this is what people can pay attention to. And then he also says, these are the directions for further research. And then I was thinking, like, in what journal, if this paper would have been submitted now to a journal, like, what journal would have accepted it? There should be way more room. I think, like, the Academy of Management Discoveries is, like, one outlet, but this is Journal of Management. And, you know, we shoot this format, like, we're all exhilarating. We're so excited about this paper, and I know it's a key reading in all major org theory, org studies, PhD programs. We should celebrate this concept and really make work relevant for practice.
I totally agree, Greta. I mean, he calls it also the assemblage, and that's really what's happening within the paper. So concepts from different disciplines, putting them together. Is much creativity in this article and in his analysis. I'm glad you mentioned his implications for practice, because what I liked about that was very much not so much his focus on, or actually that he doesn't focus on rules, regulations, systems, but very much on the personal side of disaster management, the communications, the informal practices. That's something where we can learn. That's something where we can learn from. And I guess that's also relevant for our current situation with the corona crisis. Who are the experts involved? Which disciplines are connected to policy rules, implementation procedures? I think that's that. Also, there we need creativity, and not only the medical professional perspective, but also other relevant perspectives. For instance, also related to team dynamics, because in many countries there's a very small team that's kind of making the rules that we are living by now. So also there we need to be open for these informal aspects.
I was going to start my reflection by seconding what Greta said, and I think it's interesting that if you read most papers by Vank, not only this one, I doubt they would be published by the current standards of today's journals, you know, but I will just leave this out there and say that what I find interesting, and I'm going to use Michael's point to do a typical devil's advocate, because I can never, you know, resist. I think that the real, push, and he has an interesting critique of Perot and talking about how it is structuralist almost, because I think what he gets very well is, I'm going to repeat myself, the enactment, the interplay, and moving the conversation of complexity away from just technology in itself, from the way technology is organized, and that invariably involves the way people work. And then we get all these things that he was able to unravel, that, you know, research, you know, just think about the whole story of the Challenger that came, the book that came after this paper, you know, we have been able to see anew how the socio-technical, if you want to go with Tavistock, or the informal-formal, or the person and the organizational all mesh together to create such things.
Yes, I love that meshing idea, because one of the things I was thinking about when Michael was talking about coronavirus was, we have lots of isolated experts that are pretty good at what they do, but they really don't have any experience in this communication system of systems aspect that Greta was talking about, where the contexts are different, and now the focus isn't necessarily on curing this patient or doing the best things for these patients. It's about how to coordinate with public safety and the restaurants and the economy and the government and these things. And I would say in the West, largely, we have no experience with this. And so when I hear people saying the government should have done this and they should have done that and they let us down, my perspective is, yes, in hindsight, that's very clear. You can see what they did or didn't do, and then you can have these retrospective judgments. But two things to remember is, it's not like people didn't see coronavirus coming or the risk for it, but it competed with many, many other priorities that seemed more pressing. These interruptions, so maybe there were many people that said, oh, we want to do this, but they kept getting interrupted by these casualty cases or that bomb or that other thing. So there's challenges there. And then I think it's a big mistake, and I think Greta alluded to this a bit, to analyze these organizations and look at these big things. Wykus talks about the micro parts, and I think when you, the way he did this, and I think all of us talked a little bit about that, was the way he did this was looked at individual level and then distilled from that some ideas from practice and what, you know, what the difficulties were. And I think it's a mistake in the case of coronavirus to say the government should have done X. Well, who is the government? There's no person that's the government. It's a system of systems that functions as the government. So I think you need to keep that in mind. And I want to briefly clarify my comments about simulators. I wasn't arguing that simulators are not useful, but they have their limitations, right? So simulators are wonderful for certain kinds of things, but I think what Wyke draws our attention to, and maybe not directly, but it's more implied, they have limitations that you have to address in practice because there's this tendency to revert to what you're used to doing for the past 10 years and not what you've been doing for the last 11 hours, as Greta was talking about. And then when you're fatigued, and in fact, they don't frequently simulate fatigue in simulators. They do sometimes, but it's not something you do all the time in the simulator. And so that's another thing to think about, the difficulty of those. And like Michael, I've read this article many, many, many times and looked at the implications for practice and have tried to practice all of those things and keep them in mind. And my favorite parts were the four conditions under which you're most vulnerable to false hypotheses, because we talk about a lot in accident management. Oh, they lost situational perspective, which is not a very good term, because all that means is Greta watched what Ralph was doing, saw him trip over the stairs and said, gee, I would have looked up. I wouldn't have done that because I saw what he was doing. Yeah, because if Ralph had seen that, not been carrying the cake and five other things and looking up at Pedro because he was up on top of the stairs and greeting him, Ralph wouldn't have done it either. I don't know if it's all that helpful to talk about, oh, they lost situational awareness, but this idea that you are most at risk to these biases for false hypotheses when you expect something, right? It's what you're used to hearing. When you want something, and I would say really badly, right? It's not just about, oh, I want it. I want it really badly. So you want it to be true. And then, of course, preoccupied with interruptions, as Greta mentioned. And then the other thing that White points out that we pay a lot of attention to in the Navy is when you finish something. That's when you're at tremendous risk because there's this tendency to relax. And you see it in football all the time where one team will score a goal and the other team tends to relax and bang, the other team comes right back and scores another goal. And it frequently occurs in football matches. But I want to yell at the screen, that's Wyke! Wyke talked about that. But nobody hears me because they're just cheering.
Ralph, you mentioned that you kind of describe Wyke as taking a more individualist perspective. But, you know, how I read the paper, it's really multi-level. And he places it in systems thinking. And, you know, like that's something that it's not being used that much anymore in current research in organization studies. But, you know, his big argument is all about the system. It's about how a loosely knit linear system can become a tight knit parallel system, and how these multiple tiny mistakes and misunderstandings then can have, you know, it's kind of the butterfly effect, the ripple effect. It becomes this big disaster. And thinking about complexity theory, you know, it's the same thinking. You know, this is what I found a major insight in understanding, like, why didn't we see coming that, you know, Corona wouldn't stick to China, but it's, you know, all over the world, the impact it has in the US, in the UK, we're now runner up to becoming the worst impacted country in, well, Europe. You know why? And you know what it is? It's exactly these hierarchies. When you think of Europe, you know, we just had Brexit. Like, how are we going to coordinate? England left Europe, and so there was insecurity about the role relations within the European Union, and how should we coordinate the response? And thinking about, you know, like, what would be the repertoire? Did we have anything before? And then we couldn't contain it anymore. So the when you think about, you know, the formal hierarchies that were there before and decision-making had already been interrupted, then we had the major outbreak with Corona coming from Asia to Europe, and then we had insecurity, like, what, like, there, I cannot talk for the people that were involved, but, you know, understanding, like, this theoretical insight that a loosely knit system becomes close-knit when you're confronting a disaster like Corona, and that instead of one mistake only impacting one thing but multiple things is a major insight that I think is super relevant for decision makers and policy makers today.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Riener, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Pix Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton-Wirta, and Gabriel Van Bonnen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for part 2 of the episode here on Talking About Organizations.